Hamas warns Israel of massive missile strikes if Tel Aviv carries out its threats to assassinate Palestinian resistance leaders. The EU foreign policy chief says it's looking for a middle way to end the deadlock in the talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. China is stepping up efforts to contain a COVID outbreak in Beijing by mass testing millions of residents. Hi, welcome to World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Palestinian resistance group Hamas issuing a strongly worded warning to the Tel Aviv regime on plans to target its leaders. The movement says it will burn the Israeli occupied cities to the ground with massive missile strikes if Tel Aviv carries out its threats to assassinate the group's leaders. Hamas says it will not remain indifferent to Israeli threats and that Tel Aviv will pay the price for any such foolish act. Also, Palestinians in the city of Khan Yunis have rallied to denounce the regime's threats to assassinate Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. Israeli authorities called for the assassination of top Hamas officials after a Palestinian stabbing attack left three people dead in the city of Eilat 3 days ago. Another deadly operation hits an Israeli city amid mounting tensions in the occupied Palestinian territories. The incident happened after Israeli settlers, backed by the regime forces, stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians have hailed the operation in Eilat, saying it represents their anger at Israel's desecration of Muslim holy sites.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Eilat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 3/5, 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled, or killed or expelled, from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Eilat operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression.
Now, no reaction when an ally crosses the lines, but there is talk of condemnation and criticism when it comes to rivals and adversaries. And that's the stance adopted by the West, with Ukraine being an obvious example. Western states have been providing it with moral and material support during the ongoing war with Russia, but they're calling on both sides to exercise restraint when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, what signal does such a behavior send to Israel?
The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting. While many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including U.S. President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. It's the United States sees an advantage, and in putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case Russia, they decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about in effect the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
Now moving on, the European Union's foreign policy chief says that he's looking for what it calls a middle way to end the deadlock in the talks for the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. In an interview with the Financial Times, Joseph Borrell said that the EU is making a last-ditch effort to address the U.S.'s sanctions on Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. His interview was published ahead of EU negotiator Enrique Mora's visit to Tehran, planned for Tuesday. The talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA have stalled for weeks. Tehran says a sustainable deal in the Vienna talks hinges on a pragmatic decision by the U.S. to make up for its past mistakes. The Islamic Republic demands that the U.S. remove all sanctions and provide guarantees it won't quit the deal again. Nationalist Party Sinn Féin is celebrating its first election win in Northern Ireland's history. It's potentially putting the country on the course to break away from the U.K. and reunite with the Republic of Ireland. That was a topic of discussion in our News Review program.
Syed Poor is our correspondent, joining us from London for the latest on this. We also have Andre Murphy, an Irish journalist and political commentator, joining us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Syed, over to you. You have lots to give to us in the form of a roundup, if you can, of the different wins and losses, of course.
Yes, Gava. Here in the in England, as you heard the Prime Minister Boris Johnson say, it was a tough night for him in the evening of the Thursday's elections, but not catastrophic. But we did see the Conservatives lose a lot of seats, especially in some of their strongholds, such as Wandsworth, as well as Westminster and Barnet. These are districts inside London and also beyond. That was huge for them. On the other hand, big gains for the Labour Party. The people I talked to hoping that Labour will be able to emerge as the largest party in 2024, when the next general election will be held here in England. The reason, there are multiple reasons, starting from Partygate to the rising cost of living, as well as the sanctions they imposed on Russia with the military conflict in Ukraine, that have come to hurt vulnerable Britons here in the UK. And a number of other reasons. Over in Northern Ireland, as you said, Sinn Féin, the first time poised to win this election and be in the seat of First Minister, pushing the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, these are people who want to be part of the United Kingdom, into second place. That raises serious questions about the future of the union, as you said, as well as whether or not the UP will agree to play second fiddle to Sinn Féin. There are others who are pushing, really, or taking it another step further and saying there is a possibility that this will bring back what the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 put an end to the 30 years of the troubles or conflict between the Protestants and Catholics, the Republicans and the Unionists. Over in Scotland, the SNP is bound to come on top. That also is going to put more wind in the sail of a call for a second referendum. They have been calling for it for a while now, rejected by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But if they do indeed get the mandate, of course, it's not legally binding. It'll still have to be agreed upon by the Prime Minister. And if that happens, then you're looking at Scottish independence that they have been calling for a very long time. And that, just to sum it up, put future union in the United Kingdom into question.
Okay, great. Let's listen to some of the online posts on this, and we'll get right back to our conversation. Our first post, my family is from a Protestant background in Northern Ireland, and I don't think the SF win, or Sinn Féin win, is as scary as it might have been back in the days when Adams and McGuinness were running things. Hopefully, they choose to govern and not just try to work towards unification. Next post, Little Britain going from strength to strength, I see. I was born years before the Troubles started. To see Sinn Féin win an election in Northern Ireland is absolutely surreal. What could Sinn Féin's Northern Ireland election mean for reunification? Sinn Féin supports Irish reunification, arguing Brexit accelerated the debate. But what will a win mean for the future of the UK? Our next post literally had a whole section in their manifesto entitled Planning for Unity. It pledged to work to achieve a citizens' assembly and a date for a referendum on Irish unity. Do commentators believe they should renege on this pledge following their endorsement? And Sinn Féin is Northern Ireland's most voted party. According to preliminary counts, it is the best election of the independentists, as it says, since the Good Friday Peace Accords in 1991. Big defeat for the pro-British Democratic Unionist Party and Boris Johnson. Right, let's move on to Andrea Murphy. Andrea Murphy, at this point, we're looking at, obviously, Sinn Féin. I'm sure they're ecstatic about this, as the video proves that point. Ultimately, though, tell us what their ultimate goal is here, or one of them, and from what we understand, is to unite with the Republic of Ireland, if I'm correct in saying that, if you can give us your views on this.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's really important to put it in the historical context that we're 101 years since the partition of our country, the designing of the Northern State, which was to be a unionist state for a unionist people with an artificial majority built in. It was maintained with discrimination against the Catholic and Irish population, and often with violence and repressive laws. And now, 100 years later, we have Republicans who were not welcome when they were born into this state, now holding the majority of power. It is absolutely seismic what has happened. The vote itself took place on the anniversary of the death of hunger striker Bobby Sands in 1981. There is so much historical resonance as to the significance of this, of what's happened. For Sinn Féin, they are dealing with the Good Friday Agreement being under consistent attack, not only by unionism, who is really unsure as to how they deal with the emerging nationalist majority. They are unsure, and the British government, who really reneges on international agreements all the time, whether it's the Good Friday Agreement or whether it's the Brexit Agreement, and the special measures that have been put in place in the North. You know, so Sinn Féin wants to do power sharing, wants to do it with those who are unionist and those who don't designate as either unionist or nationalist. And now they'll be at the centre of making the decisions around that with the first ministry position. In parallel with that, there is a growing expectation that there will be a vote within the next 5 to 10 years on Irish unity. It's overwhelmingly supported in the south, and there is a lot of signs that there is a growing population leading to a majority, certainly half and half, that would like Irish unity north of the border as well. And for Sinn Féin, obviously an Irish Republican party that wants to see unity in the country, it is very much a supporting the Good Friday Agreement mechanisms, ensuring that there is power, effective power sharing, but also contributing to the planning for what a united Ireland will look like in 5 to 10 years' time, to ensure that another chaotic Brexit doesn't happen, that it doesn't just happen kind of without the planning that's necessary for a new country.
Thank you so much for that, Andrea Murphy, Irish journalist and political commentator from Belfast, Saeed Pourreza. Thank you so much for giving us an update on all of that. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back. Chinese officials are once again mass testing millions of residents for the coronavirus across several districts of Beijing. This is part of a campaign to stamp out a small outbreak before it morphs into a Shanghai-type crisis. The daily caseload in the capital is in the dozens. This has led officials to close gyms and entertainment centers and many public transport routes. Still, the measures are far more lenient than the economically damaging lockdown, which has almost confined people to their homes in Shanghai. There, daily infections were in the tens of thousands at their peak in April, but the city saw its daily cases fall for the ninth day on Sunday. In Brazil, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has launched his presidential bid for the upcoming general elections in October. Economic recovery is his campaign's main promise. Addressing his supporters in Sao Paulo, Lula called for unity around democracy. He also stressed the importance of focusing on sovereignty and environmental issues. He criticized the performance of incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro, calling his administration incompetent. Lula served as the president of Brazil between 2003 and 2010, and his Workers' Party is now ahead in the early polls. Handling of the COVID pandemic, rising inflation, and high fuel prices are the main issues that Brazilian voters are concerned about. And that brings it to the end of this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
Avirik Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listener's Special on this beautiful Sunday, May 8, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listener's Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English radio programs. If you have any message for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, of course, your program. And here I truly appreciate those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Pradeep Chandra Kanda from India, Anant Mohan from India also, and Sixten Niman from Finland. So Pradeep, Sixten, and Anant, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And of course, we've received many emails and letters from around the world, which I mention some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails and letters. First of all, Abu Sayed from Bangladesh has sent us an email from Finland. We've received two emails, including an email from Sixten Niman, and also from Olof Ratovara from Germany. We've received an email from Alex Koroba. And Jacques Augustin from France has sent us an email. And for your information about the reception reports, as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL card or an eQSL card from us. Anyway, many thanks for being with us. I will be back with these great emails from around the world. Please stay with us. Well, Abu Sayed from Bangladesh has sent us an email. Let's see what Abu Sayed says. Dear friends, we are a group of old listeners of IRIB English Radio. Much has been written before, but due to being busy lately, I haven't been able to write to you regularly. However, I make sure not to miss visiting your website and listening to the programs. Looking forward to writing to you once in a while and send you my comments regarding your programs. I hope I can keep in touch with you more often. I would be very happy to receive from you a calendar and some souvenirs for our club in the new year. Salam and warm greetings to you, Abu Sayed from Bangladesh. And many thanks for writing this email to your radio, IRIB English Radio. So you said you are a group of old and regular listeners of IRIB English Radio. And you regularly write to our radio and, of course, your radio, IRIB English Radio. And thank you very much for that. I mean, writing to IRIB English Radio once in a while. And that's great. It shows your, of course, your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. My colleagues soon send you and an EQSL card as a confirmation. Of course, sending any material, including a calendar and souvenirs and promotional items of IRIB English Radio to our listeners around the world in the time of pandemic is not possible. Of course, after the pandemic, we will send you these promotional items, but now it's not possible. Sorry for that. But for the time being, please accept an EQSL card for you and for a group of old listeners from Bangladesh, Abu Sayyid. Thank you very much again. Write to us soon, please, and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. And from Finland, we've received an email from Sixten Iman, one of our old and regular listeners. So Sixten Iman from Finland says, "Dear IRIB English radio staff, I had a great pleasure to pick up your radio here in Nekralby, Finland, this evening. I'm enclosing a recording of your broadcast, including your station identifications. I would be very glad if you would verify my reception of your radio. Thank you very much in advance. Best regards." Salam and warm greetings to you from Iran and from IRIB English Radio. To you, Sixten Iman from Finland. And please accept our appreciations for sending us such a great email. Yes, we've received the recording of IRIB English radio broadcast plus station identifications. Thank you for that. Thank you again for sending us this email. My colleague will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a confirmation. Write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon. Sixten Iman from Finland. And after a short break, I will be back with another email again from Finland, from Olof Ratavara. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. As I said, Olof from Finland has sent us an email. Olof says, "Dear IRIB English radio staff, greetings from Finland. Thank you for verifying my listening report. In my opinion, the program I heard was good and useful. Also, I listened to the world news telling that what Iran thinks about the situation in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, talks in Vienna, London, and Johnson, Palestinian issue, US and Biden. So, you cover almost all the interesting world issues. There are interesting articles and mindful lectures on Islamic issues. It's promising that Iran, Russia, and China want to speak with one voice against unfair world politics. I like that IRIB English Radio points out important things like the so-called third world countries should have independence and autonomy to decide their own things without intervention of superpowers. Best regards, DX listener from Finland. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Olof Ratavara from Finland. Olof, I wish I'm right in pronouncing your name because I don't know Finnish. thank you very much for sending us this email. So, you listen to IRIB English Radio World News, as you said. You know every issue regarding the world developments, which is broadcast by IRIB English Radio, including the Palestinian issue, the talks in Vienna, the situation in Yemen. That's great that you listen to world developments, which is broadcast by IRIB English Radio World News. That's great. And you said you also listen to articles in the program, like In the Limelight and Mindful Lectures on Islamic Issues. So you listen to all the programs by IRIB English Radio, and that's great. It shows your, of course, your support and commitment to our radio and your radio, of course, IRIB English Radio. That's great. It made my day, the news, hearing such comments. Thank you very much for telling us your views about IRIB English Radio. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Please write to us soon. Please write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Olof Ratavara from Finland. Thank you again. And from Germany, we've received an email from Alex Choroba. Alex says, Dear Madam or Sir, at IRIB English Radio, I would like to report a reception of your radio broadcast. Enclosed, you find my reception report and an audio record as evidence for my reception. I would be glad very much to receive a QSL card for your station for my collection. Sincerely yours. Salam and warm greetings to you, Alex Choroba from Germany. And please accept our gratitudes for sending us this email. Yes, my colleague will soon send you an EQSL card. Of course, sending a paper QSL card to our great listeners is not possible at the time of pandemic, but please accept our EQSL card as a confirmation. Thank you. Please write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. Alex from Germany. So, after a short break, I will be with you with the last, but not the least, email from Jacques Augustin from France. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and I'm here with an email from Jacques Augustin from France. Jacques says, Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, despite regular tests, I was not able to listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and this made me more enthusiastic to write to you. So today, I am pleased to submit my reception report to your consideration. I hope this report will be helpful to you, and if checked and found to be correct, can you send me the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran QSL card as a verification? I was pleased to listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its religious program on Islam and talks on the holy month of Ramadan, the month of forgiveness. I think this point is important. As a conclusion, I wish this letter has pleased you. Looking forward to hearing from you. Best regards and stay safe. Salam and warm greetings to you, Jacques Augustin from France. And please accept our appreciations to you for sending us this great email. And thank you very much for telling us your views about IRIB English radio programs as you listened to different programs, including religious programs on Islam and talks on the holy month of Ramadan, the month of forgiveness, as you pointed out. Thank you very much for that. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a verification, as you've requested. Jacques, please write us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. So, please stay with us. I will be back with you. So, before wrapping up this week's edition of Listeners Special, the Sunday program, your program, here, I want to appreciate those of our great listeners who have sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Pradeep Chandra Kanda from India, Sixten Niman from Finland, Anand Mohan from India, Jacques Augustin from France, Alex Choroba from Germany, Olof Ratavara from Finland, Sixten Niman from Finland again, Abu Sayed from Bangladesh. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with Listeners Special and IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. Have a good time and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the developments in Ukraine, one topic overpowers all of the rest, and that is military assistance. From the U.S., who is leading in arms and weapons assistance, benefiting the U.S. arms manufacturers, to NATO member countries. Brings about the question, is the U.S. pressuring these countries to follow its anti-Russia policies? While at the same time, some EU countries, while voicing their all-out support for anti-Russian sanctions, continue to buy Russian oil, and in particular, gas. This edition of The Spotlight will be focusing on those issues. But first, let me introduce our guests. Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan joins us from Sacramento, California. Also joining us, writer and political analyst Gerard O'Coleman joins us from Cork, Ireland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome to you both. And Cindy Sheehan, let me first start with you, if I may. And out of the things that are pretty much dominant these days when it comes to the military operation or war in Ukraine, are the military cells. I mean, we just keep hearing about military cells, left, right, and center seems to be the focus. The latest U.S. President Joe Biden, which stood out in terms of the highlight, if you want to call it, this Lockheed Martin company facility in Alabama, and then thanking the workers there and keeping up with the orders. Why is the U.S. is not obviously keeping that behind closed doors anymore. It's out for that. What is your impression of the U.S. intention here?
Well, I mean, the U.S. intention against Russia and Putin has been evident for many years, but especially since 2014, when the U.S. and its envoy, State Department envoy, Victoria Nuland, in 2014 supported the neo-Nazi takeover of the Ukrainian government and the evident Russia gating, saying that Putin was responsible or Russia was responsible for Trump, that has turned out to be an absolute lie. And the one thing that we've noticed here in the United States, I never needed it to be evident, is that the one thing that the United States still manufactures is weapons, and it's the leading arms dealer around the world. And it's sending billions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine, which, of course, is a U.S. proxy war against Russia, just like the in the 70s with President Jimmy Carter and Brezhnev. That was a proxy war in Afghanistan against the USSR. And so to talk about how much money the arms industry is getting, the military industrial complex in the United States, is of course a terrible thing when we're here paying so much money for gas and groceries, and there's hyperinflation just coming out of the lockdown. Our economy is getting worse and worse, and it's still the case of a few profiting and a lot of people in misery. And the bad thing is the Ukrainian people are caught in the middle of this. And, you know, the U.S. Political class, the military industrial complex, plus its supporters in the grassroots are willing to let this go to the last Ukrainian sacrifice. And that's the sad thing about it. And I'm sitting here. I have, you know, children and grandchildren and a community that I love. And the whole world could be affected by World War III. And this continuous push to arm Ukraine and to demonize Russia is not going to end well for anybody unless people step in and say, we need a negotiated ceasefire right now, and then talk about the terms of that so it doesn't escalate further into something worse than it is right now.
Well, unfortunately, if you have the weapons flowing, it's just going to continue, Jacques Coleman.
Absolutely. That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
Jacques Coleman, that's the logic behind weapons. They keep flowing. War will continue. And what was very shocking, in a sense, is what this Lockheed Martin Raytheon spokesperson actually said. These two military manufacturers actually make the weapons that many of these countries that I'm about to ask your reaction to. And this spokesperson said, we are exploring options to more quickly replenish U.S. inventories and backfill depleted stocks of allies and partners. One thing that many people don't realize is that the military equipment that NATO member countries actually purchase are from the U.S. So, and here we have the NATO countries, in this particular case, Lockheed and Raytheon spokesperson saying that, you know, we can't fill up the orders as they're coming through. Is how big a drive is military sales in this conflict?
Well, certainly the goal of the U.S. geopolitically is to divide to separate the European peninsula from the Eurasian landmass. And the key point, the key pivotal point there is Ukraine, because that's the separation point where they can basically separate the Eurasian landmass, Russia, China, from Europe, which is essentially a peninsula. Now, of course, there's a question about where Europe starts and ends. The Russians see Europe as going from Lisbon to Vladivostok. But the Americans want the European peninsula to be a client state, so a unified client state of the United States. And this has always been the policy. So they need to stop Russian oil going into Germany and fueling a German industry. The arms sales, of course, is how you basically make this work. I mean, the U.S. has been putting military bases all around Russia and China for many years, and they need to maintain the global military. This is the new Roman Empire, and of course, like the Roman Empire, it's falling, it's crumbling, and it's taking everybody with it. So right now in Europe, we're all paying the price for this crazy policy. It's become almost obligatory to support Zelensky. It's almost obligatory to be pro-Ukraine. They have Ukrainian flags virtually everywhere in Europe now, in schools. Everybody's gone around with Ukrainian flags. So we've been subject to a major brainwashing campaign in the media to demonize Russia and to eulogize Ukraine, of course, ignoring the presence of neo-Nazi shock troops in Ukraine, atrocities being committed on a daily basis. And of course, they have been committed for many years now, since 2014. I mean, I could mention some of them, such as the burning people alive in Odessa in 2014, one of the worst massacres possibly since the Second World War anywhere in Europe, completely ignored by the Western media. So these are the kind of people, you know, the arms are going to. This is what this industry, the military industrial complex, is funding. And the British are very involved, of course, and the French. So these are the key allies of the United States, and perhaps more than allies, puppet states at this stage of U.S. foreign policy. And so the U.S. simply wants to continue that Mackinder-inspired policy of dividing the Eurasian landmass. And the key point there is Ukraine, because it is that point which, from the North Sea to the Black Sea, where the United States can basically militarize that zone and then create a sort of an intermarium where Russia is blocked from Europe. Of course, the consequence of that is that we're paying higher fuel costs. We're paying everything is going up. So, you know, what it will do essentially to the ordinary worker in Europe is bankrupt him. Middle class and working class people will be bankrupt. Businesses will go bankrupt because they cannot keep up with the prices. We have a situation in Ireland, for example, where farmers now have to get loans to get fertilizer. So sooner or later, this is going to crack. The question is when. But, you know, it will also lead to a food crisis, I think, because food prices are already going up. Germany's already experiencing a food crisis.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a bit in terms of
I think the damage is going to be enormous.
Sure. Well, let's try to get a clearer picture over here as to what's really happening, Cindy Sheehan. I mean, when we talk about the fact that you have NATO member countries and European countries in particular coming out condemning Russia, some analysts are saying that that's due to U.S. pressure. Now, how is the U.S. pressuring these countries? Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but the U.S., through Zelensky now, because I recall distinctly that Zelensky said that other European countries could become a target. And that's the line, one of the lines that the U.S. is pushing in order to get them to cooperate and move ahead with sanctions, move ahead with military assistance. Because there's a void, not only in their own security apparatus through their armies or what have you, but their reliance, because they're a NATO member of the alliance as a whole. Is that a correct way of depicting this?
Yeah, the U.S. is very famous for using the stick threats, but also the carrot, the promise of, you know, contracts, oil contracts, money, aid. Most of the aid that the U.S. gives, as you mentioned, is military aid. So it's like we're giving money to countries that are going to come right back to the defense contractor. So it's almost like a welfare for the defense contractors to send this aid to NATO and NATO countries that comes back to them to fill their coffers. And so there's always the stick and the carrot in U.S. foreign policy, but it seems like the carrots are also, you know, not very healthy, not very, very positive things. And, you know, I agree with the other guest here in the United States. The fear propaganda is out of control with Putin is another Hitler, and he's going to not stop in the Ukraine. What we saw and what we've been watching very closely since 2014 is that Russia has, with Putin at the head, has shown an extreme amount of restraint in dealing with this Ukrainian issue. Your other guests mentioned the burning of the Union Hall in Odessa, but since 2014, the neo-Nazi sympathizers in the Ukrainian military have been killing people in Lugansk and Donetsk in the Donbas region, between 14 and 20,000. And I just wonder what the U.S. would do if Mexico killed 20,000 Mexico, the country, the government of Mexico, killed 20,000 U.S. citizens, like in Baja California. Would the U.S. wait 8 years for a military response? And, you know, I doubt it. So Russia, like your other guest said, is feeling surrounded by the U.S. and NATO countries. And I'm just wondering what their response should have been and what other countries would have done in that same circumstance.
It seems like the rhetoric coming from the U.S. in particular, leading the pack, and then, of course, member countries, but in particular the U.S., Jarrah Coleman, is very harsh. And it's almost like taunting and provoking Russia in new ways. For example, very interesting that you have a headline reading, U.S. intelligence is helping Ukraine kill Russian generals. And then you have the details come out that this may have led to 12 Russian generals to be killed, which was a target on that ship to be one of them. And then you have Biden saying, you know, these types of leaks should not come out from U.S. officials. It's almost as if he's mocking the fact that this happened. Not mocking, but by saying that, it's provoking Russia. Also, other news where U.S. is training Ukrainian troops in Germany, and that may be going on in other parts of Europe, of which John Kirby said we can't disclose those locations yet. Is the U.S. trying to elevate this war to another level?
They've been provoking Russia since way before 2014. I mean, it erupted in 2014 with the coup. But since then, they've been hoping for this war. It's not that they don't want the war. Russia doesn't want the war. Russia never wanted the war. It never wanted the coup in Ukraine. It never wanted the entire crisis. This is a pain this is a major crisis for Russia itself, and it doesn't need this crisis. Russia has enough problems to be dealing with. Look, they've been provoking wars on the periphery of Russia for a long time, with color revolutions all over Eastern Europe, Georgia, recently in Kazakhstan. And so they're destabilizing the entire periphery of Russia, Eastern Europe, right into Central Asia. And the aim of this is to provoke world war, essentially. Now, we're in a situation of world war. If you're at war with Russia, and we are at war with Russia, it's a world war, because, of course, it will involve all of Russia's allies, China, Iran. Everyone will be drawn into this because of the global repercussions. And we're in, I would say, the phony war phase of a world war. In other words, it's sanctions, economic crisis, a percolating crisis, destabilization, escalation, and so on. We haven't yet gone into full-scale war where the Russians are retaliating. Of course, the West are actually prepared to provoke Russia into full-scale retaliation. We have people like Nancy Pelosi in the United States saying that it's okay if we go to full-scale nuclear war with Russia. Of course, that means that nuclear missiles will fall Americans, so she doesn't seem to be too bothered by that. Prepared to go for a full-scale with Russia. That will end very badly, and possibly for the United States, but it will certainly wipe out several cities in Europe should the Russians be forced to retaliate. Now, I doubt very much that the Russians will hit Europe first. I think that if Russia is hit, if Moscow is hit, if they cross the border into Russia and start targeting Russian cities, then Russia, of course, will retaliate and European cities will be hit. And, you know, this is where we're at now. And this is a world war. It's the first. We're in the preliminary stages of a world war. Russia hasn't crossed the border yet. But I could see this, you know, escalating, and they certainly want it. This is the problem here. They're not talking about negotiation. They're not talking about reestablishing the Minsk Accords. The door is always open. The Russians have had a very intelligent foreign policy in this regard, because Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus has kind of played the role of intermediary, and it has worked well for Russia, but also for anyone who actually wants to negotiate with Russia. So the door is open for negotiation, but the West doesn't want negotiation. They want full-scale war. It seems that they're prepared to go as far as nuclear war, which, of course, is a situation of mutual annihilation. But, you know, we're living in very disturbing times, and we're ruled by insane elites. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. These people are mentally insane. Biden is mentally insane. Pelosi is insane. So this is the scary thing. You know, right now in Europe, there is, of course, a major division between the hardcore belligerents and those who are more inclined to favorable diplomacy with Russia, such as Hungary, Czech Republic, Serbia, and so on. And, of course, that is a major weakness. I think a lot of people want to get out of this. They see that there's no point in pushing Russia any further.
Sure. Well, I mean, when we want to take a look at the intentions that the sanctions had, Cindy Sheehan, the ruble has actually recouped most of its losses, based on the report that I read. It's become the top-performing currency globally, and it continues to gain, and it's up 60%, looking at its performance for the month of March. If you want to take a look at the Russian gas deliveries via Ukraine, it's hit a five-month high, and there are 10 European countries that are quietly buying Russian gas, even though the EU has come out and said that, you know, it's banned. I mean, you know, you can't buy Russian gas. So the intended results are not, they don't have that maximum impact when it comes to sanctions. But what is having an impact is the material or the information that you gave us, Cindy Sheehan, from your part of the world in Sacramento, of which you're looking at high prices, inflation, stagflation, maybe the U.S. may be heading towards a recession. 1.2% contraction was recorded. You have things like what's happening in Europe with energy costs and people who are obviously suffering. And it's really sad to see. It's mostly really the poor who are suffering the most out of this. And the list goes on and on. Is the world suffering because of what is happening, based on the U.S. leading the pack into this?
I think that this is like the culmination of U.S. foreign policy, especially since 9/11, 2001. And I see that, yes, people here in the United States are suffering economically, and they're not putting together that the sanctions and the reliance on this destructive military-industrial complex industry is harming everybody, from, you know, babies to old people. And so they're not putting two and two together. They've been told, as your other guest said, that nuclear war is winnable and survivable. And so there's a situation in the grassroots where half of the people that ally with the Democratic Party, align with the Democratic Party, are believing this. And then we have the people on the right who have always been pretty war hungry, and they're couching their propaganda in terms of being, you know, that this is a humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. And I know this is getting a little bit off the topic, but my energy always goes around what's happening to the people on the ground. So people are really sad, you know, here in the United States for what's happening in Ukraine, not even taking a look or hearing about the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Israel, you know, war against the people of Yemen, and that actual humanitarian crisis there, where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have died from sanctions and bombing and, you know, things like that. So the military-industrial complex here, mostly in the United States, I say global imperialism led by U.S. imperialism. We do have a